I share these opening words from Melissa Kwasny, whose book, Earth Recitals, this comes from. When I feed the birds, standing on the ladder beneath the tree with my bucket of seeds, the chickadees land on the branches around me. They are so delicate, their legs like black string tied around the thinnest limbs of the poplar, their tiny eyes focused on me, each move a heart flutter closing in, coasting just past my hair or my hand. At least 20 of them, I feel gifted by their tameness. They are an other life come close, trusting me, though it's true I have earned their trust. I feed them suet and seeds. Chickadees live on an average 3 years or so. So this might be the sixth or seventh generation I am feeding. They create a halo around me, each lighting up when they settle as stars do, around a center star or sun. For a moment, I have become their center of gravity. They hover in place as my friends, as my family does, creating a sensate world that surrounds me before I and all of them vanish. I welcome you on this blustery morning that looked like winter might not have left yet. Whatever pulls you into the sense, your sense of place in the world, whatever orbits in your sphere, your realm of attention, love, the radical root of Unitarian Universalism, invites us to open our hearts and focus our minds in its great powers. Please take a moment to greet those around you with warmth and gratitude for this precious moment.
Good morning. Got a gregarious bunch this morning. That's great. Well, I'll be real short. I'm Jessica Sievers, and last Sunday, Michael had asked me to share for the chalice lighting what some of my beliefs were. And ironically, I did not look at the principles before I wrote this. I promise you that. But I think you'll see some similarities. I believe in truth and honesty, peace and freedom, hope, forgiveness, growth and education, interconnectedness, and most of all, love.
Now, as you're able, stand and sing The Spirit of Life, our opening hymn, number 123. We'll sing it two times. Please take a moment to look at our announcements in our order of service. We have a number of things that help give structure to our life as a community that extend way beyond this morning. I would also like to invite those of you who would like to be a part of the Deepening UU class to join us this afternoon at 12:15. We will be looking at our roots and how we might grow out of them. That starts at 12:15. And now it's my pleasure to introduce someone who has worked tirelessly as a part of a team, and I think Phil and Joanne are still married. Is that true? Yes, so far, right. Anyway, that's a bad joke. Sorry. I couldn't help it because he and Joanne have been putting together what is an enormous, enormous event, and he's here to share what that might mean for you.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Phil Radebusch. I'm a member of the UU Fellowship in Topeka, but a longtime friend of the Manhattan Fellowship. I think I first began coming here periodically almost 25 years ago, so it's good to be back. I guess I also have eternal hope because despite the snow swirling this morning, I planted lettuce and peas in my garden yesterday. So, as Michael said, I'm here today, and my wife, Joanne, who's also the co-chair of the Regional Assembly, is in Lawrence this morning with that group, and here really to highlight the first-ever Mid-America Region UUA Assembly that will be held in four locations. Topeka is one of those. There's a location in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Indiana. And it will be April 11th through 13th. Topeka is one of the host congregations, but Manhattan is listed as one of the host congregations as well. And so I wanted to give you some highlights of the assembly. I'll be here afterwards, be glad to talk to anybody about it. And we still are looking for some volunteers, both in Topeka here and Lawrence, to help on that weekend. So again, it's April 11th through 13th. All the details are on the Mid-America UUA website, so I would encourage you to go and look at that. This conference has been more than 2 years in the planning. On Friday afternoon, there is going to be a workshop on racial justice. It'll be at the Brown versus Board National Historic Site. So if you're interested in that topic, it will be part of the conference on Friday afternoon. There'll be an opening ceremony Friday night. We'll have a banner parade. We'll have a video greeting from Peter Morales, UUA president. There'll be a song festival and Vesper service. There is distinct programming for elementary age students and for those in middle school and high school. They will be going through age-appropriate programming at the Brown versus Board historic site. The elementary age children will also be spending the afternoon at the Kansas Discovery Center. So if you have children, please encourage them to come along. The keynote address on Saturday morning is Reverend Paul Razor, who is a leading now UU theologian and academic. Paul was actually a member of the Topeka Fellowship before he went to seminary, and it'll be good to have him back. He still has family and friends here. There are 19 different workshops on Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon on a variety of justice topics. One that I'm particularly excited about is we had a member of our congregation that 3 weeks ago was invited to Washington, D.C., invited by the White House to be involved in a faith-based, and sometimes that gets to be a loaded term, but a faith-based initiative looking at global warming and sustainability, and really was there representing our fellowship that's done a lot in that area. And that, I think, is a really exciting an example of many other workshops that are there. There'll be an advocacy event Saturday afternoon. We're going to carry our banners and wear our Standing on the Side of Love shirts to the Capitol and speak out to all who will listen at the Capitol. There is a business meeting for those that are interested in governance, but more group singing on Saturday night. Your own Michael Oldfather has been very involved in the music team to put together the musical elements, and we're going to be singing and worshiping a lot together. And Ann Zimmerman, who is part of your service later this morning by way of her voice, will provide the theme song for the conference and a workshop and will be part of the weekend. And then the closing service on Sunday, your own minister and the others in Lawrence and Topeka have put together a really nice program, and Michael's been involved in the music. So I would encourage you to attend. The registration is online at the Mid-America UU website. If you're interested in volunteer activities, I'll be around afterwards and be glad to talk to you. And again, it's good for me to be in Manhattan. Thanks.
Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would like, please now share a brief personal statement of a joy or a sorrow or some wonderful mix. I would like to share with you that Franz Samuelson is still in the hospital. He's a long time associated in the very early years of the fellowship. He will be moving to Bramlage, hopefully, on Tuesday. If any of you are interested, please visit him. This is a lonely journey. And then, of course, Catherine Hedges' mother had a stroke on Thursday, I believe, or Wednesday. She has flown out to be with her. Hopefully, her mother is stabilizing with the love and attention that a daughter can bring. If you have something you would like to share, now is the time to do so.
Well, Michael, good morning, Sue Prey. There's a new soul in this world. I have a granddaughter. I happen to have a photo. But this is an eight-day smile. Look at this. It's like, I know. Usually they're 2 months after all the diaper changes and feedings, but they got it in 8 days. So, okay.
That's her granddaughter.
Can you top that?
Michael Oldfather, I'm accustomed to being second. 2 years ago today, we moved into a townhouse. I haven't even looked at a lawnmower in over 2 years. I've shoveled a tiny bit of snow, and I've pruned a couple of branches off a tree that was in the way. But otherwise, I'm a free man.
I think I'll come around.
My lovely daughter, Leah, is 8 today.
This isn't personal, but the Topeka Capital Journal is reporting that Fred Phelps is on his deathbed. So in whatever way you want to keep him in mind, I think that's important to all of us in some way or another.
Again, Phil Radebush from Topeka. My son is captain in the U.S. Air Force, and he just returned 10 days ago from deployment overseas. And he grew up in the fellowship in Topeka, and he was able to go to church there last Sunday, and it's continuing to be a blessing that he's back safe and sound. Right.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts. All right, Sandy.
Are we plugged in? Is this good? Good morning. Good morning. A lot of the children in their RE classes this semester and last semester have been learning about lots of different religions. What are some different religions that anybody at all can remember that maybe you've touched on? Nick? Catholicism. That's this week, so that's good that you have that much memory. Buddhism, older group. That was Nick is in the third through sixth grade, and Leah's in kindergarten through second grade class. She's a second grader. Maeve or Lily, any? Can you remember any? One. Last week, what did you talk about? Starts with a C, and then H. Other religions. Anybody else? Well, Michael asked me to do the story today, and I, because of the kids learning some of these other, touching on some of these other religions, I read this book, and it touched me. And if you know the punchline already, keep it to yourself, okay? This is called The Mountains of Tibet. So, what religion do you suppose that is? Tibet. Yeah, that's good. Ronan?
Buddhism or...
Could be anything, really. Wherever you are, you could... Yeah, right. In a tiny village in a valley high in the mountains of Tibet, a little boy was born. He loved to fly kites. On clear nights, he liked to look up in the Milky Way and the stars. There are other worlds up there, he said to himself. Someday, I'm going to visit them. He grew up to be a woodcutter. As he gathered his wood, he looked out beyond the far mountains. There are other countries out there, he said to himself. Cities and oceans and people of other races. Someday, I will go and see them. But he was always busy with his work and his wife and his children. He lived to be very old, and he never left his valley. He died. He found himself in a place that was both very dark and very bright. He heard a voice speaking to him. The voice said, "You now have a choice. You may become part of the endless universe some call heaven, or you may live another life." "I want to live another life," said the woodcutter. The one I just lived has faded from my mind like a dream. All I can remember is that I wanted to see more of the world. Look around you, said the voice. The woodcutter looked around and saw all the worlds of the universe. They blazed and spun like fireworks on New Year's Eve. Hundreds and millions of worlds, said the voice. They are called galaxies. Each one is different and each one is beautiful, and you may choose any one you'd like to live in. Then the woodcutter heard the galaxies singing to him. Choose me, sang each one. The woodcutter was frightened and his head began to spin. How can I choose? He cried. Choose from your heart, the voice replied. There was a pinwheel-shaped galaxy that looked like a great splash of milk. I like that one, said the woodcutter. That galaxy has hundreds of millions of stars, said the voice. They come in all shapes and sizes, and anyone you like may be your own. All the stars of the galaxy sparkled for the woodcutter. They flashed like fireflies in the woods on a summer night, but one star caught his eye. Its light was warm and golden. Okay, now, this is a book. You have to, little license coming up here. I'll take that one, said the woodcutter. That star, said the voice, has 9 perfect planets revolving around it. Which one would you like to be your home? The woodcutter saw the 9 planets, each in its place. One was huge with swirling clouds, another red. One had sparkling rings around it and many moons. One looked like a blue-green marble the woodcutter had had long ago as a boy. I like that one, said the woodcutter. Somehow it looks like home. On that planet, said the voice, live hundreds of thousands of different and wonderful creatures. You may live your life as anyone you like. Which will you be? The woodcutter looked again, and there were all the different creatures parading past him. Some swam, some chased, some danced, some flew. Come be like me, each one yelled. See how much fun you'll have. See how beautiful you'll be. There were whales and goldfish, lions and pussycats, snakes and giraffes. There were butterflies, and there were people. The woodcutter almost decided to be a seagull gliding on the sea breeze. Then he saw a child watching the seagull and laughing. The child was flying a kite. I want to be a person, said the woodcutter. There are thousands of kinds of people in this world, said the voice, each with different dances and delicious dishes, and you may join any kind you like. The woodcutter looked and saw all the peoples of the world dancing around him. They looked like flowers. There were red and white and golden people. There were black and brown and pink people. Some wore feathers, some wore silk, some wore plaids and stripes. They all danced their dances and called to him in all their different languages. Just taste this, they called, holding out their most tempting dishes. This is the hardest choice, thought the woodcutter. Finally, the music of the golden people touched his heart. I will join them, he said. Now, said the voice. Where on the planet would you like to be born? It may be anywhere you like. Then the woodcutter saw all the countries that he'd never seen during his life. He saw forests and plains, and he saw deserts and green islands. He saw great cities and lush jungles, but there was one green valley high in the craggy mountains that seemed to wink at him and whisper old familiar stories. That looks like a perfect place to be born, said the woodcutter. There are dozens of young mothers and fathers in that valley, said the voice. Whichever you like best will be yours. The woodcutter felt the love of all the young mothers and fathers of the valley flow up into him. They all smiled and held out their arms to him, calling, "Come to us, come to us." He saw a man whose smile made his heart sing. He saw a woman whose smile made him feel safe and warm. I want them for my parents, he said. Last, said the voice, You may choose whether to be a boy or a girl. I seem to remember that I was a boy, said the woodcutter. This time, I'd like to see what being a girl is like. And so, in a tiny village, in a valley high in the mountains of Tibet, a little girl was born, and she loved to fly kites. Something to think about. And on and on and on. Could be. Don't know. That's it.
Shine your light in all you do. Let us share what we have to give, so that we may sustain and strengthen this place where love beckons us to continually grow into our best selves, so that we may be of service to all who need the benefits of our free faith, its belief in goodness, what loving kindness may bring to those in need of love. Let us share the offering.
That was nice to hear. I'm going to title this, What Do I Know? Also, what do I know? Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, birth and death, what is in between and what might be before and after. I wait for decisions. Maybe I hold this here. I wait for decisions, for more to happen, for a roof to be redone, for a house to close, for a blister or wasp sting to recede, for a vacation or a diagnosis, as if the waiting time is somehow partial time. Some want the facts, the Bible, the books, the replicable scientific method. And if you have a moment, people want to understand the universe, or at least be free from doubt as to important questions like, is there a God or spirits or some kind of different life hereafter or before? But what do you permit yourself to be convinced by? Certainty can't mean very much. Who can compete with a suicide bomber, a racist, a snake-bit zealot when it comes to certainty? I have to put zeal to the side. It means very little. Next, there's thinking. But how can I not mistrust the convincing thoughts of nimble minds when I cannot follow their proofs? How can I be certain as to whether there is a God that means anything relevant to me when I am relying on the lack of evidence and there is so much I do not understand? The unknown unknowns, as Donald Rumsfeld so aptly put it. Genius has led to much desolation in this world. More or less than stupidity? I don't know. And I doubt anyone else does either. So I don't trust intelligence, and I don't trust zeal. What I do know is experience. I know, and I'm certain, that there are avenues of existence to which the scientific method has not been successfully applied. But I also know, and I am certain, that the two experiences I have had, which lead me to this belief, constitute mere personal certainty and bear no persuasive weight, although it pains me to say this. Overwhelming experience is not a plausible argument. It should be insignificant except to the observer. For me to convince you of my ethereal experiences would rely on passion or persuasion. And those devices are not trustworthy, even in the hands of someone so well-intentioned as myself. I might believe non-existent things because of some misunderstanding of my own experience, although I don't think so. Is it as wrong to be defined by my beliefs as it is to be defined by my doubts? I don't know. All of which brings me to this building. I hardly fit in with any religion. But this one suits me, Unitarian Universalism. I know people disparage Unitarian Universalism because too many, it accommodates too many beliefs. Believe in something, they say. Wash the feet of the rich. Follow teachings. Let your heart pour over a holy book. Shave your head. Grow a beard. Believe. And it seems human to have need for this faith. But where has this taken this world we are part of? I think the beauty of Unitarian Universalism is it takes that risk, that terrible risk, to be called nothing when it most decidedly is not. It is the mystery. And where that might take us, I do not know.
The big picture. I'd like to start with a poem by Pablo Neruda, a poem that I've read in congregational settings for over 30 years. It still resonates, and it resonates deeper and in different ways each time I read it. Too many names. Mondays are meshed with Tuesdays and the week with the whole year. Time cannot be cut with your weary scissors. And all the names of the day are washed out by the waters of the night. No one can claim the name Pedro. Nobody is Rosa or Maria. All of us are dust or sand. All of us are rain under rain. They have spoken to me of Venezuelas and Chiles and of Paraguays. I have no idea what they are saying. I know only the skin of the earth, and I know it without a name. When I lived among the roots, they pleased me more than flowers did, and when I spoke to a stone, it rang like a bell. It is so long, the spring which goes on all winter. Time lost its shoes. A year is four centuries. When I sleep every night, what am I called or not called? And when I awake, who am I if I was not I while I slept? This means to say that scarcely have we landed into life than we come as if newborn. Let us not fill our mouths with so many faltering names, with so many sad formalities, with so many pompous papers and letters, with so much of yours and mine, with so much signing of papers. I have a mind to confuse things, unite them, bring them to birth, mix them up, undress them, until the light of the world has the oneness of the ocean. and integrated generosity. How does one arrive at a place where you feel integrated into generosity? Know something of it in your body and mind. Time cannot be cut with your weary scissors. They have spoken to me of Venezuela's and Chile's and Paraguay's. I have no idea what they are saying. I know only the skin of the earth, and I know it is without a name. So one of the ways to move into the space of generosity where things open up is to move beyond those specifics which trap us into our narrow-visioned reality, into a small identity. The shaping spirit of the imagination, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge believed, unites the living self to the living outer world, where you experience the inner as the outer, the outer as the inner, where there is no separation. I believe we all have many moments every day when this happens. It can be simple, like the first taste of a great cup of coffee, or that perfectly balanced, tart, and sweet section of tangerine. Or it may be the eagle that you seldom see flying over the prairie, and suddenly your eye goes up there and sees its great spanning wings in the sun over the prairie. The last of the sun laying itself across the hills with the attention of a great lover. Such intimacy. It can be likened to a moment of liberation when our habitual way of seeing is expanded into a generous wholeness, when we experience the complex connections without having to trace each link, each cross link. These moments of revelation can lead to seismic shifts in understanding. I'd like to read a poem I've worked on when I was on sabbatical called Pollination. And it's about a time when I was 6 years old, and I'll let the poem speak for itself. Pollination, settled on a limb. The voice warms my right ear, almost like an earache. My sixth year, my world, Mrs. Foss snooping in every window walks her Scotty. Down there looks different. Kids on bikes with training wheels, with wagons, little leagues in the fields, swings inching up the sky a long way off the end of April. Everything wants to happen. All of my body quiet, the little leaves coming out soft, anthers, the felt green, the branch and trunk support me in what I don't know, becoming fuzzy in dusk's first breath. No one sees me up here. I am dreaming. I see all below as if I never walked down there. The stream of words about how to build light. Build a nest out of sight. The golden filament. From that moment in childhood, that out-of-body experience, when I could see the whole world that was my world below me, I learned something invaluable. I, for the first time, realized what school had to teach me was important, but it wasn't as important as it had just what had just had happened. That up there, a space opened that I needed to guard and to protect and to live in as much as I could, because there I felt like I was myself. We all need to step aside from the projects and activities that consume, so much of our attention. If you are one of those people who move from one project to the next without allowing the space to open in between, you need to find ways every day, if you can, to take a moment when you're not thinking, when you're not pressing, when you are. Michael Servetus published on the Errors of Trinity when he was 19, back in the 15th century. He believed in the harmony of power, not the division into the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. This aroused a storm of controversy. This book was absolutely banned, and he had to flee. He went into hiding. There he wrote The Dialogues of the Trinity under an assumed name. He became interested in medicine. He discovered how circulation of blood moves through the lungs. His interest in the reformation of the church continued. He defined God as everywhere, the essence of all things. It cannot be made into something divided into smaller parts. He was arrested in Geneva for heresy. In 1553, he was led from his cell, bound to a stake, and with his three offending books tied to his thigh, he was lit up into a big ball of fire. This was a man who was killed because he believed there was a God who loved everything. He was a universalist and a Unitarian. A number of outrageous and courageous people in the Unitarian Universalist tradition were martyred for questioning their accepted doctrine. The big truth for them was more important than being imprisoned by false ideas. How do the big truths, meaning of those things that are connected, interconnected, the cycles of birth and death, shape your life? Help you know when you're moving in a direction that calls you to fulfill your destiny, to follow that golden filament, to know that you are on a path that lets you be yourself as fully and as dynamically as possible. Chuck and I spent 6 weeks in Guanajuato, which is an hour and a half north of Mexico City. It's one of the great cultural centers of Mesoamerica, an amazing place. And there we met Miriam Arate. She was a member of our writing group, which met every Wednesday for 3 hours. She was born in Mexico City. Her father was Mexican. Her mother was American. And when she went to high school, the high school was staffed by all the people who fled America during the years of McCarthy. So she was taught by some of the most left-winged people on the planet. And so she carries at 71 years old this banner of liberalism for the people, always for the people, in such an amazing, graceful way. She said at a writers' group that Mesoamerica is the source of so much of what shaped North America. Our culture tends to be either self-absorbed or we are always going to Europe for paintings, for great buildings, or somewhere else. We seldom realize how important all of the life that flowed from 15,000 years ago up into the southwest, into the southeast, shaped the life that was here. When we don't acknowledge how our shared heritage of living in this place on earth, was influenced by the Olmecs, Zapotecs, Teotihuacanos, Mayas, Aztecs, we sever ourselves from a rich cultural tradition that developed complex societies, reached high levels of technological evolution, built monumental constructions. Paula, Another woman in our writer's group exclaimed, "Certainly, the corn and squash central to our Thanksgiving story didn't originate in Mesoamerica." Miriam, "Oh, yes, it did." While it wasn't the first time I had heard this, this is the first time the reality of it registered with me. Stunned, I began thinking about Cherokee ceremonies related to corn. For some reason, I've been fascinated with these rituals and the corn goddesses for years and years and years. Miriam said, in the mythological pantheon of her universe of Mesoamerica, corn and thunder beings are gods and goddesses who represent the different seasons of corn. There is a rain god. Thunder gods are well recognized. These mythological creatures appear in festivals that just bloom with such flourish in Guanajuato, the flower ceremony, hearkening back thousands and thousands and thousands of years to ancient rituals. Mesoamerica's finest cultural centers integrates their pre-Spanish past into their technological savvy world of today. To walk in the streets of Guanajuato, you don't know what century you are in sometimes. Sometimes there are bandoliers from the 16th century with black velvet costumes and those Rembrandt collars singing, and you'll have 100 people following 30 singers up and down the streets. You'll have clowns get on a bus when you just think there's not one more person that can fit on this bus. They're coming in and you're hot. The windows are shut. You're shoved against the wall and you think, oh my God, if they open their mouths, I'll die. And then they start their act, and the kids are smiling and giggling. The adults are laughing. And finally, I let go and enjoy this just wild experience. Lime green makeup, red hair out to here, black shiny shoes this high, wide pantaloons just flowing through the bus with this great laughter, with this great fun. What an invitation. Miriam curates Nahuatl pottery, which is pre-Spanish cultural pottery, and she's had exhibits in UCLA and New York. She has one at the major Museum of History in Mexico, all over the world. So she's deeply immersed in this culture and knows a lot about it. She has given her life to this study. And one morning, when I was sharing a poem that I was working on, still not done, but she was stunned. She just stopped. She just stared. And when I was done, I'll read what she was stunned by. And this, I have to set it up a little bit. This is a month and a half after Chuck and I were hit by lightning. We were both suffering from brain damage and the kind of reverberations of that. And I was prone to panic attacks where I would just be unable to cope with anything. And we went to the Plaza Art Fair, and if any of you have ever been there, you know what a wild and wonderful gathering of people and music and life that can be. But I reached this moment when all of a sudden everything seemed like it was pounding on me, the big purses, the cigar smoke, the drummer that was beating on the main stage. I just couldn't take it. All I could do was run to a wall and put my face against the brick and feel the coolness on my head and just let myself relax a little bit. And then I'll read the part of the poem. And this is after this all happened. In the late afternoon garden, moths and butterflies cure. They teach me to use light, find the air, the beauty of jerky turns, land on petals, suck the inside of sweet things, test the air where monarchs land on blue mist blooms. The intricate scroll work of chalky wings, the proboscis history of nectar trails from the light-made floret, this wavering lightness so sure of what it needs to live, the side splash of lightning from Charlie threw me from the picnic bench, makes me stumble without knowing why, a glass slipped from my hand, spittle to seep, sparked in me. An odd combustion of wings. Quirky swerves keep me in my unstable universe, the unsolved parts of how all this works, draws me into something so much smaller than I. What do you do when your psyche is wounded, when you feel beaten by the world, when you have lost something so precious and you know you will never get it back, what do you do? One thing you can do is, as Miriam quickly pointed out to me, that this whole intricate scroll of chalky wings and the proboscis history of nectar trails is central to their flower ceremony, which is a healing ceremony which goes on for an entire weekend, where the whole city of Guanajuato is flooded with flowers, and there is this dancer with a huge horn proboscis. He's just a proboscis. He is telling people, get your nose into the flowers, bring in the nectar, get pollinated, become alive, allow the natural world to do its work. Let yourself be a part of this great and beautiful and ongoing mystery. She said, that is exactly what I see when I hear you say that. I see those people from thousands of years ago moving into today. So touching on myth, the use of imagination, sensing the deep level of myth, that release of creative imagination. Emerson said, a path or circuit between things through forms. Between things through forms, a circuit. A dual life of imagination, Melissa Kwanzi says. Both earthly presence and symbolic presence, literal and figural, poems spoken or sung. The individual experience of truth, the shared experience of truth. Seymour, Philip Hoffman, many of whom you knew as a great, great actor, was probably considered the best actor of his generation, killed himself, or he died of an overdose in February. It is said that his performance of Willie Loman and the death of a salesman, that iconic play that looks deeply into this culture of competitiveness, of always trying to beat out others so that you can get the money, disturbed him to his very core. He had been in rehab many times. He relapsed, and for the first time, friends saw him drinking. He had to move out of his house. And then, of course, he was discovered by one of his best friends the next morning, dead with a syringe in his arm on the bathroom floor, with 50 bags of heroin littering the apartment. Now, we all know that sometimes we need something that will help with the pain. We all know that. But if you don't use what's natural, what comes through time, it will only be a band-aid, or worse, it could become a devastating journey into death. A glimpse of the high that heroin can give you, I don't know. But I can only imagine what it must feel like to be floating above all the problems that plague you in the everyday world. So I think this is a reality many people face some people are just tortured by. So anybody who is so sensitive that they take in all this pain, there's got to be a way of releasing. A true sensing of the big picture so that it becomes real and a healthy part of your experience of the world opens you up so wide that nothing for a moment, a passage of time, can interfere with its true power. This is not just a vision of beauty or horror. It's not just the complete understanding of something, an understanding that has eluded you, but within the experience there is always something of an element of the possibility for transformation. So what wants to push you down or makes you want to just get drunk or just wants to make you smash your hand against the wall? In that, there is the possibility of transformation. And why and how? It requires a movement from knowledge to wisdom, from practice to being. You can't impose meaning. You can't make a poem mean something. The poem has got to come alive from its own imaginative world. If you start imposing something in a poem, it just deadens, it flattens, it becomes just like something you might read in a newspaper article. You can't impose meaning. It must come out of the experience itself. We know that reading provides us a great escape, but it is not a replacement for wisdom. It happens in those moments of full integration when you feel a lightness, a sense of absolute everything coming together. And maybe it may be flesh or extended, but within this reality, you understand how the universe works. You get this glimpse. Sometimes it just happens. It may come after years of effort, after a death, deep mourning, falling in love, betrayal, after a great period of creativity. All of a sudden, something becomes clear. Duh, why didn't I get it before? When it fails, when people think it must be their way or the highway, close down on a personal, individual understanding, fail to sense the deep connection, when the details become so precious that you forget the wideness of human experience and the true connectivity that each of us represents in this great web of existence we share. When you're tight with anger, regret, expectations, need to control, think of Mr. Rogers, who devoted his life to helping children and unsuspecting adults learn how to be good neighbors. How can we be better neighbors? Is there a person you are holding a grudge against that you can't talk to, or something you simply can't let go of because it just spins around and around and around, and you are right, you know you're right, and you may be right, but what does that spinning do for you? It cuts you off from all the people that you love, all the people that you care about. It alienates you. I know this may sound like simple logic, but there's power in Mr. Rogers' simplicity. Less excuses, more reasons to open up. Mr. Rogers had a spiritual practice, and it was defined by someone who wrote a book about him, and it's this: stay simple so you can go deep. The more you hang out on the surface complexities and contradictions and all those things that eat at that sense of being connected, make it impossible to go deep. if we let go of the chatter, if we let go of the details, not always, because we know they're extremely important, especially when that surgeon is operating on your heart. We want him focused or her focused. That's clear. It's not one or the other. But there needs to be these moments when we let go. If you fail to go deep, Mr. Rogers says, you'll never see the incredible oak tree or the sunset or the sunrise or the look of a lover in your eyes. Or the starry night, you will cut off your power to love the world that opens your power to focus on the big picture where we are all a part of what it means to be human in this space with this breath now. I have papers everywhere. So, we really don't have much time for sharing, so why don't we move into song? Hymn number 131, Love Will Guide Us. And thank you very much, Beth, for helping us out today. Stand as you're able and let us sing together. Have a mind to confuse things, unite them, bring them to birth, mix them up, undress them, until the light of the world has the oneness of the ocean. Go in peace and have some coffee and let us get together. Thank you.